Welcome back to the Mel Kay Show. If you have been watching my show for quite some time or have seen my speeches that I've given all over the country about what we are really dealing with on a global scale, you have certainly heard the my great guest today's name before. Ian Davis has taught me personally more about the nature of what we are dealing with, where it comes from, how we can fight it, and has been a voice of sanity and reason for a very long time. Thank you for joining me, sir.
Oh, thank you very much, Mel. It's a pleasure to be here. Thanks for inviting me.
And oh, it's been a long time. I've wanted you to come on, so the pleasure's all mine.
Well, I'd just like to thank you for you know, spreading the message and really getting my work out there. And I've seen the presentations that you've given, you know, presenting my work to a wider audience that I wouldn't be able to reach on my own. So my thanks go to you.
Well, I hope this today helps even more and maybe starts a dialogue that we'll have ongoing, because I do want people to know that I first found you. You were one of the first people during COVID that was calling it was what it was. You were actually putting out pieces in real time saying, this is not what's going on. It's a plan. I call it the plandemic. This is what it's about. And then from there, you started digging into who benefits, why is this a global situation? Where's it coming from? And really digging into the UN and all the tentacles of the globalist octopus, as we call it, and all of the different machinations all the way up to the international banking cartel above them. And it's just so revelatory that when I found In This Together, and now iandavis.com, and now you have the Substack, I mean, I felt like I took a college course the minute I found your work. So let's talk a little bit about your background a bit, because you're an extraordinary researcher as well.
Oh, well, thank you very much. Yeah, I'm an autodidact. I'm not, I haven't got any particular qualifications that would enable me to do this work. My background is in health and social care. I work predominantly with people with substance misuse issues. So, I've got a bit of a background in counselling and CBT and that kind of stuff. So, not that particularly helped me as a researcher, but it's always something that I've been very interested in. I've been a union member and a union steward and so forth for many years. So I wrote for kind of like union magazines and things like that. But nothing particularly that would lead me to do what I do now. I think 9/11 happened. And even then I didn't cotton on straight away. I think it was a few years of processing. And I think what shocked me most about 9/11 were the questions that I thought were pretty obvious to be asked that were never asked. And I think that's what kind of piqued my interest. And then I started the blog, I'm going to say, in about 2010. It was very much a hobby. It was very much something that I was doing in my spare time. And I think the book that really kind of struck me, that made me start to write the blog, which was, as you quite rightly said, used to be called In This Together, but it had loads of hyphens in the URL and nobody could remember it. Right. So I thought, oh, well, that's a kind of waste of time. But I think the book that really struck me, that made me really think about things, was actually Brzezinski's The Grand Chessboard.
Yeah.
Because what struck me in that, and it was a realization in my life. And I read that quite a few years ago, so I'd always known it, but I'd never really explored it, was that there really are human beings on this planet whose intention is to manipulate the world. Their intention is to manipulate nation states, and they openly discuss doing so and how they do it. So that came as a shock to me. And I realized that the seat of power that we imagine, is the place where we think power is invested, is not where power is invested. Power is not invested in the political class to any great extent, I would suggest, but it is. You know, I think there are senior members of the political class through which power is exercised, and the extent to which, you know, kind of the most senior politicians are not, and I wouldn't necessarily say leaders necessarily, not the figurehead leaders, you know, prime ministers and presidents and so forth, though I think that is possible sometimes. The extent to which power is exercised through the political heavyweight. So it's usually people that are behind, you know, an example that we might think of, you know, someone like Kissinger, or, you know, more latterly Brzezinski, and these kind of characters who are policy advisors that are very much working, you know, for various administrations, or for in our case in the UK, for various political parties.
Right.
It's through them really that we can see the exercise of power. So, for example, I mean, a great example is Nixon is very famously spoken about for his 1971 visit to China, where he spoke to Deng Xiaoping, and it was about the opening up of China and so forth. But that visit was preceded, and almost a year earlier, by Kissinger going.
Right.
So, and Kissinger was an envoy of the Rockefellers.
Right.
So then we get into questions of asking about, you know, who is someone like, for example, Kissinger in that example, who are they representing? Are they representing the American people, or are they representing vested interests? And I think when we start picking things apart and start looking at the evidence, it becomes clear that it's vested interests, that's who these people represent, and that continues to this day.
Yeah, you know, I've come to calling it the parent company of planet Earth. They think that they run planet Earth, and we're just lucky to be here. And they manipulate it from the very top. And I will put a link to your amazing chart. But once you look at that, and many people over the years, as I've shown it, and I always say that it's yours, and, you know, go check him out. But once you see it, you can't unsee this. And then once I started learning about the public-private partnership, the multinational stakeholders, all the way up, you trace it all the way up to the BIS, you can never not see it anymore. It just becomes very, very clear. But also what's happened is that they've been exposed by your work and other work. And I know you do work with Whitney Webb, who's also exposed a lot of this stuff. And it's not debatable, but something that you've also attacked is that anyone that gets close to that, they use the old Warren Report, CIA conspiracy theorist moniker as a attack mechanism. And you've been very good at pointing out that the people that are calling people the conspiracy theorists are actually working for this same group. They're kind of a PR firm. I see the Center for Countering Digital Hate, or that one in UK, is meddling in elections all over the world right now. One of the many groups that is involved in the conspiracy theorists, the misinformation, disinformation industry. This is somewhat new. So you had been already doing this when this entire push to make anyone that was looking at the parent company out to be a crazy person. So can you talk a little bit about when you first started seeing the disinformation, misinformation, you know, Ministry of Truth start to really, in my opinion, panic and take it to the next level?
Yeah, no, I agree. They're definitely panicking. Yeah, they've lost control of the narrative, and they are panicking. I think, you know, we can go back to 2016 and see documents that were coming out of the United Nations that were talking about the threat of disinformation and the threat of misinformation. And now they've added a new and quite extraordinary term, malinformation, which is, you know, for your viewers that don't know, malinformation is information that is actually true. It's information that is actually true, but presented in a way that is inconvenient or something. To be honest, I really haven't got my head around this one. But anyway, yeah, I mean, you can go back to really, I mean, even following after 9/11, for example, you know, there was a push then. We saw Bush give a speech where he said, you know, it was important that let us not accept outrageous conspiracy theories such as 9/11 being a false flag, blah, blah, blah. So this is at the UN General Assembly, which I would suggest, even for a leader like then President Bush, is a big deal. You know, it's a big deal for a world leader to speak on that platform.
Right.
And then and then we saw that process continue through to, you know, in 20, I'm going to say 2011, or it might have been 2014. We saw then UK Prime Minister David Cameron say a very similar, give a very, very similar speech where he was talking about how we need to tackle extremism in all its forms.
Right.
So most of us would consider extremism to be perhaps the incitement of violence or the incitement of genuine kind of racial hatred or, you know, perhaps calling for armed insurrection or something like that. I mean, no, I think most reasonable people would consider that to be, you know, an extremist position, you know, depending on the circumstances, of course. But I mean, in most circumstances, most people would consider that to be an extremist position. But they've been shifting the goalposts towards saying that merely questioning the narrative, the official state narrative, is an extremist position.
Right.
Well, if we think about what our democracy is supposedly based upon, our democracy is supposedly based upon the questioning of power. It's not based upon our agreement with power or our trust in power. It is based upon the questioning of power. You know, we the people. That's what it is supposedly about. That is being taken away by the very people who claim that they are defending democracy. They're destroying all democratic principles. They've got absolutely no belief, and they're openly showing this now. I mean, the United Nations are pushing forward with something called the Cybercrime Treaty, the long name of which I cannot reel off, but most people are referring to it as the Cybercrime Treaty,
right?
Which openly states that the term it uses for misinformation is anything that undermines trust in the I can't remember the precise wording, but it's words to the effect undermines trust in the institutions of government or harms the interests of business. Of, you know, so they're saying that they're openly stating in proposed global treaties that questioning the government or questioning or undermining or damaging the interests of big business is what they call misinformation.
Right.
So you know, this is the antithesis of what most of us would consider to be the most important free democratic principle, that is the ability to speak freely and question power.
Right. And one thing that I definitely learned from you was a little bit about the scam that is the UN concept of human rights and developing nations that they never seem to develop, but they really help with their PR campaigns to make sure that there's constantly a need to help developing nations and many other things. But what I didn't know, because a lot of people still out there think Davos and the World Economic Forum is some benign networking group and the UN is totally separate and that they're all about peace and helping people. Meanwhile, in your work, I found, and I suggest everyone go read his work all the way back as he talks about the public-private partnership and all of this, they actually have been one in the same for a very long time, way back to Kofi Annan talking about it. The UN and the World Economic Forum are not, you know, two different groups that are working on two different things, correct?
Yeah, no, that's, I think they are, you know, they're two different organizations. They're both organizations in their own right, but they are partners and they've been partners for quite some time. The World Economic Forum have got an official partnership with the United Nations for accelerating Agenda 2030. But you can, I mean, if you look at the history of the United Nations itself, when it went from being the League of Nations to the United Nations, the what we now call today the Secretariat, which is the civil service, if you like, of the United Nations, the mandarins and the bureaucrats in the halls of the United Nations, that was created by the Rockefellers. So the Rockefellers set up the basic administrative kind of glue, if you like, of the United Nations. So, you know, it's always been what I would call a public-private partnership. It's a partnership between The governments that we elect, which we think hold power, which I would argue increasingly don't. I think the balance is very much shifting towards private power and private corporate power. And we can certainly see that in the financial sector. So there's this partnership between public and private interests, which lies at the root of kind of all the kind of intergovernmental and globalist institutions. And one of the things that I think that you're referring to in terms of and what Kofi Annan said at Davos in 1998, yes. I think he said that there'd been a quiet revolution at the United Nations. And what that revolution was, that the United Nations no longer concerned itself with the governments of the world, but now also concerned itself with the businesses of the world. Well, this was just, you know, so what it's saying is the United Nations is a representative body of both government or governmental institutions and corporate institutions such as World Economic Forum, with whom it has, you know, an openly declared partnership to accelerate Agenda 2030. So that's 200 of the world's most powerful global corporations, which is, you know, when we talk about the WEF, people kind of think it's, you know, as you quite rightly say, it's some sort of talking shop that they have once a year at Davos. The WEF is a sprawling, I mean, the analogy of, you know, the octopus, Rockefeller's octopus, you know, spanning the world.
Right.
It's not a bad analogy to apply to an organization like the World Economic Forum. Yeah. I wouldn't say that it is the, you know, I think sometimes, you know, people kind of focus on the World Economic Forum because it has been so prevalent during COVID.
Right.
You know, with the Great Reset, and we, you know, was the book was called COVID-19, The Great Reset. So, I mean, you know, it's understandable why people would see them as kind of perhaps leading that. I mean, to my mind, I think what they were doing, they were leading the kind of PR push.
Right. That's what I say, too. They're like the PR firm, and they represent all of that. And then for us in America to see that Larry Fink is on the board of the World Economic Forum and runs BlackRock, which I would say is probably he's probably has more power than anyone in our government in America right now, in my opinion. And Jamie Dimon, I think these people are running above, like in Tragedy and Hope, or Rockefeller himself saying that a moneyed class of intellectual elites is far superior than autodetermination of the people. I believe that those are those people and that they are functioning like that. But when you see that Larry Fink is also on the board of the World Economic Forum and the Council of Foreign Relations, and somehow BlackRock can do business in the CCP without any interference, it seems, or so they say, you can't not put together that there's something going on above our governments that is manipulating things. And I think you also spoke about, as I have, Larry Fink talking probably 6 months before the COVID, he made this speech about going direct to the people. And it's a very ominous speech, if people can go back and look at it, where it sounds like what he's saying is that, okay, we've had it with playing this game that the governments actually have power. You know, the corporations and the multinational corporations and the international banks have to step it up going direct. And to me, that meant skipping the Constitution, the Bill of Rights, and the people, and going direct to manipulating behavior in the direction, and I would say towards achieving Agenda 2030. That's how I see them. And you also point out the banking institutions. So how do you see that whole thing where, you know, Fink and then, you know, he has the meetings where there's people from the Bank of England, there's people from the Shanghai Corporation, there's people from, you know, banks all over the world getting marching orders, apparently from this opaque BIS is kind of at the top of this. But there seems to be a banking group above all of our nations right now.
We are right now in $34 trillion worth of debt. We have geopolitical chaos everywhere. The central bank digital currency is looming. The BRICS nations have expanded beyond Saudi Arabia and continue to expand. And all I know is that many experts keep telling me that gold and silver is the best way to hedge against inflation and to protect your savings going forward. Did you know you can convert your 401k and IRA into physical gold and silver today? It can be shipped direct to your door or stored in a secure location. So go to our partners page at themelkshow.com, fill out the form, and someone from Beverly Hills Precious Metals will get in touch with you right away to help you figure out the best course for you and your family ahead. Stay secure, stay safe, and prepare now.
Yeah, and I think we're seeing that with the digital transformation of money.
Right.
So I think, you know, central bank digital currencies are very much a big part of it. But I agree very much with recent work and recent research done by Whitney Webb and Mark Goodwin, who have been looking at, you know, the role more of the role of private banking in, you know, in firms, the yeah. private banking giants, JP Morgan and so forth. You know, like looking at their role in the digital transformation, because, you know, I think JP Morgan has already issued what it's called its deposit token, right. which is a digital coins, stable coin type thing that is, you know, represents deposits, but it's going to be programmable. So it's, you know, all the things that we spoke about with regard to central bank digital currency in terms of it being the danger of it being programmable. I think the important thing for people to get is digital money, whether it's central bank digital currency or whether it's a privately issued programmable stable coin, is nothing like money that we are familiar with. It's a completely different concept. It's, for a start, it's never yours. It's not your money. It belongs to the bank. Or that is true to a certain extent with all money anyway. But you know, it's not like cash. It's not like something you can hold in your hand that you can choose to spend on whatever you want to spend it on. It's not like that. It's programmable. It can be spent on whatever they want you to spend it on.
Right.
Or not. With regard, or not. Or can be blocked. So, you know, for example, as we saw in Canada with the truckers' protests, right. where that's a perfect example of public-private partnership, because you've got the banks working in hand with the state. The state makes the government make some sort of declaration that, you know, people can't support the truckers' protest. And then the banks work with them to shut down people's ability to make payments to support the truckers' protest. So who is, you know, as you rightly say, I mean, I talk about the Bank for International Settlements, the BIS, being very much at the top of this pile.
Yeah.
And that's very much at the top of the financial pile. And I would argue that finance and economic power, financial and economic power, rule the roost, I would say, even more than military power, because you can't fight wars unless they're financed. So, you know, finance is very, very important, I would suggest. So you've got someone like Fink who with going direct, what we're talking about with going direct, really, it's a coup. That is a coup. Because if we think about, so the idea of going direct was that they would get central bank money directly into the hands of us. Right. So at the moment, our financial system doesn't work like that. Right. We have what they call a split financial system. So what they call base money, which is the money that comes from central banks, does not filter down directly into our pockets.
Right.
You know, that money is created by commercial banks and private banks when they make a loan. So that's where that money comes from. It's created out of thin air when they make a loan. But that's not the same as base money. Base money is what banks bank with. So what Fink was saying was that this system needs to be changed. This system needs to be completely eradicated and altered. We need to get... So this is a paper that was produced in 2019 that was presented to the at Jackson Hole, to the G7 bankers at Jackson Hole.
Yeah.
And they presented this idea of circumventing the traditional way of that money and finance works, and putting central bank currency money, which could be in the future, could be central bank digital currency, directly into the marketplace. So giving it directly to investors. I mean, we say, I just said, you know, giving it directly to us, not much of it filters down to us. The first adopters are the investors, the globalist investors. They get it first. So they're the ones that get the benefit of that money. Now, governments really only have two functions. They gather money in terms of tax, and in terms of taxing us, and in terms of gathering resources to control resources. and they operate fiscal policy. So fiscal policy is about, you know, what the money's spent on. We give them money and they decide what they're going to spend it on our behalf, allegedly. So like we would like them to spend it on hospitals or, you know, repairing the roads or right. improving, you know, transport infrastructure. That's not what they spend it on. What they spend it on is wars and shutting down farming industries. That's what they spend, Agenda 2030, which is not even a government idea. That comes from the UN. So, well, not even the UN, actually. But, I mean, it comes from the think tanks, the globalist think tanks. So, in this right. case, the Club of Rome, very much the Club of Rome.
Right.
But that's all they can do. So, fiscal policy is a really important part of what governments do. Fink was saying, forget about governments. We'll control fiscal policy.
Right.
That is fundamentally the idea behind going direct, that we control all spending, in effect.
Right.
So that really was a coup. And that was presented to the G7 bankers in 2019. Then we had, and I think that the wording was saying it would only be triggered in extraordinary circumstances.
Right.
Well, lo and behold, just a few months later, we had a global pandemic, right. allegedly, which triggered the precise conditions that Fink laid out.
Imagine.
To instigate a global financial coup, which is what they did.
Yeah, 100%. And that's, you know, and we find ourselves right now in this place where a lot of people are thinking, you know, how did this happen? It happened over the long term, but then they triggered it. Then the COVID came. You wrote a great series and books about what was going on in there. It also, at that point, BlackRock was giving out the money that was going to the people during the PPP loans. They had something to do with that as well. So like you said, it just so happens that they had their extraordinary moment in time that they needed. And since COVID, we have seen a lot of the things that they put in place stay. And one thing that I think is most dangerous, you brought up earlier, 9/11. To me, I think the worst thing that's happened to America, other than joining the United Nations, is the Patriot Act. After 9/11, these people, while the American people were, and we'll talk about the psychological operation as well, because you really break that down. But the people were looking for answers. They wanted to blame somebody. They were traumatized. We've had a lot of big trauma incidents in America, including the JFK murder, other things that were done that the public was very easily manipulated and damaged enough to agree to something. But what came out of the Patriot Act, in my estimation, is a intelligence branch of our government that is unconstitutional and should not exist, being the DHS, TSA, DNI, other groups, but also the NSA. And we had the Snowden drops from the NSA. Then Obama and Holder put in the DOJ National Security Division to be like the persecution side of this whole blob. And I believe that intelligence blob has overtaken the other three branches of government and is completely out of control. But then I read your piece with Whitney about Agenda 2030, number 16, and digital ID. And I'm looking at what they've done since 9/11 with the intelligence branch that is unconstitutional and shouldn't exist. And then their relationship with the Five Eyes nations, all of their intelligence that is warrantless surveillance. If they can't do it here, they'll have them do it. Then they go into a deal with all the big tech companies, this intelligence branch of my government that is in bed with the UK government, Australia, Canada. And then they have a deal with the EU. So when you guys are talking about the global digital ID that would include the central bank digital currency, it appears that all of this has been a slow walking one step after another towards that. And that is what I think people have to understand is the most dangerous, and that they cannot achieve Agenda 2030 without that aspect. So can you talk a little bit about that side of it?
Yeah, no, you're right. Digital ID is the linchpin. Digital ID is the thing that will make us controllable. Digital ID, they call it onboarding. This is what they're talking about with central bank digital currency. So they're saying that in order to make sure that onboarding, which means you signing up for central bank digital currency, is safe, they have a thing called Know Your Customer, KYC, whatever it's called, Know Your Customer. So in order to know your customer may be, must be able to validate who they are to the system. So that means some form of digital ID. Now, I think it's important to remember that that most of us already carry some form of digital ID.
Right.
Digital ID itself is already here. So for example, in the UK, driving licenses are biometric. So biometric data means that your face is is machine readable. So on driving licenses in the UK, you've got a machine readable image, and we've had that for years. But it is not linked to a centrally coordinated database. So although, you know, the DVLA in our country, the people that control the driving licenses, they've got a database of our faces. It isn't centrally linked to a larger system. The police can access it, but the police have to apply to access it, that kind of thing.
Right.
The purpose of what they're calling interoperability, which is a buzzword that you see everywhere. The Bank for International Settlement are practically obsessed with it. You know, the World Economic Forum are always going on about it. You know, people like Bill Gates are always going on about how important it is. Tony Blair, you know, these kind of characters. Interoperability means unifying the entire system. That's what it means. It means making everything digitally constructed of digital components, including our digital ID, interoperable with every other aspect of the system. So, for example, you know, once your digital ID is approved for onboarding to buy a Jamie Dimon stable coin or whatever that you want to purchase, you think that's all that it's asking you of. You think that the digital ID that they're asking of you to do that is for that purpose. But through things like ID 2020, what they're creating are what they're calling the ID 2020 have got a set of standard regulations, I think they call it, a set of standard, or I can't remember the precise word, but a set of standard regulations by which all other digital ID must comply. So no matter where you think you're getting your... So because they know that they can't sell, it's a very, very hard sell for them to sell us a national ID card.
Right.
You know, a lot of countries, especially in Europe, a lot of European countries and in the UK, they've tried to introduce national ID cards, and the public has always rejected it because they know that it's about coercion and manipulating us. So what they're going to do is they're going to sell you a digital ID product. They're calling it vendor agnostic. So they'll send you a vendor agnostic digital ID product for accessing a stablecoin, for example. You'll think that's all it is, but what it is interoperable with the entire system, which means you have now entered onto what they're calling the universal ledger.
Right.
So we don't know yet what the universal ledger, which is going to be a blockchain ledger of everybody's ID.
Right.
I'm talking everyone in the world. We don't know which database platform is going to get that. At the moment, the World Bank's ID 4D looks likely. The World Bank has said that its ambition is to have digital ID, and they use, you know, weird terminology, digital ID for every human between zero and above. So every human being, right? Does it just say that? But they aged zero and above for some reason, which means everyone, I think, you know, unless, I don't know anyone that's under zero. But
it in the womb, they mean that they'll try that too.
They'll probably chip you in the womb. Yeah. So that's what they're aiming for. That's their ambition. And I think the important thing is that when people talk, when you mentioned it earlier, that, you know, people that talk about this stuff are called conspiracy theories theorists or whatever. The notion of a conspiracy theorist is that the person, this comes from the academic literature about conspiracy theory, that the person believes that secret societies or secret cabals rule the world, right? So we need to be clear that there's nothing secret about their ambitions.
Exactly.
It's not a secret.
Exactly. Right? Yeah.
They publish this stuff. The World Bank has openly published its plans to digitally ID every human being on the planet.
Right.
It's not a secret. You can go and read it.
Right. And you do read it and you put out a lot of this stuff. And we know about our common agenda and the World Health Organization, because this digital ID will not just include, and I'll share a link to your and Whitney's two pieces on this, won't just include your digital ID. It will include your World Health Organization vaccine mm-hmm. pass and your travel pass. And I guess Al Gore and his cop friends have the climate trace. And then they have the social credit score aspect to it, which then brings me to something that you've pointed out more than most people seem to grasp at all. And we brought up China and Kissinger earlier, and we all know, Larry Fink, but also another nefarious character of the parent company, at least running America, Eric Schmidt, were very involved in the China track and trace surveillance system that they already have there that totally controls everything with the social credit score. And again, you're alienated from society if you're not participating in this on top of that. But one thing that I think a lot of people got maybe confused about during learning about the Great Reset, learning about the Great Narrative, learning about these different arms of this, what I call the octopus of global control, was that China and Russia actually are in on Agenda 2030. But because of what's going on, a lot of people have thought, well, it's us against the BRICS nations or the BRICS nations against us. We're really above that. You're going to see at Davos that China, the CCP at this past Davos, I did a whole week with Nour bin Laden live from Davos. The CCP was treated like the bells of the ball. They were the VIPs in Davos. And at the top of the UN and many of the agencies are members of the CCP. And then you hear Klaus Schwab and Bill Gates and even Rockefeller back in the day, Kissinger, talking about that the CCP runs their resources better and that should be the model for the world, the resources being us. So can you just talk about the misunderstanding that we're dealing with, that China and Russia and these other nations aren't really involved, because they are involved. And I think that makes people very confused about that it's actually a real global push. It's not just some nations and not others.
Yeah, I think we need to separate the propaganda that we are given and in both East and West.
Yeah.
But different propaganda. The propaganda that we are given and the narratives that we are given to believe about who is the enemy and who is the, we are given these bogeymen in order to convince us to comply with whatever crazy lunacy stuff they want us to do next.
Right.
For example, the constant accusations about Chinese interference in everything from elections to hacking people's data systems to everything. So China is an advanced economy, or it's an emerging economy, but in many respects it's very advanced, more advanced than some Western economies. Of course the government indulges in things like propaganda, disinformation, hybrid warfare. Of course the Chinese government does that, just like our governments do, because right. There's no difference, because our governments are doing exactly the same thing. The stories we are given that it's only China, it's only Russia that do this kind of stuff, it's not. It's all governments. Well, all, I would say, leading governments, powerful governments around the world, first world governments, they are all engaged in the same game. Now, when we come to things like sustainable development,
right.
One of the arguments that you get that China have got nothing, they're not interested in sustainable development, for example, is the number of coal-fired or gas-fired power stations that they are building at a rate of knots. Yes, absolutely. China are absolutely doing that. But I think what people, again, are confused by the propaganda, if you like, is that they think that because organizations like Extinction Rebellion and Just Stop Oil believe in the climate alarm propaganda, that governments do. Governments don't believe it. Governments don't believe in it. They don't act as if they believe it. Governments are simply using the climate alarm propaganda to, again, manipulate their populations and behaviorally control all of us. Right. The same is true in China. China, I think, was praised, and it might have been by Schwab. I don't think it was Schwab, but I can't remember. But China was recently praised for the speed with which that they are introducing renewable energy. So China is building renewable energy on a scale you wouldn't believe. Now, does that mean that China really, that the Chinese government really thinks that windmills and solar panels are going to power its industrialization? No, obviously they don't actually think that, because they're also building,
right,
as most people will point out, a shed load of fossil fuel powered power stations.
From our farms to your family, all organic protein, fruits, vegetables, gut health, immune support, and so much more. We have products for weight loss and collagen and muscle building, products for children, athletic performance, and 30-day programs for just $12 a day. You can save $50 on your first purchase of $75 or more with the code MelKWellness. Go to the MelKShow.com partners page and check out MelK Superfoods today.
The important thing I think to remember is that the stories we are given are not a reflection of reality. Then, you know, we are given stuff to believe in that is preposterous. It's ridiculous. Yeah. Now, with regard to China and Russia, so for example, in China they have Summer Davos. So Summer Davos is held in China in June, I think, or July. So they hold exactly the same thing. It's just Davos in China. It's called Summer Davos. We were talking about Larry Fink and BlackRock. So BlackRock have been the first company to be given a completely foreign-owned global investment firm based in China.
Right.
So BlackRock are in there. And we can go back in history and look at the history of the Trilateral Commission and the Rockefellers in building up China's economy to what it is today, which they undoubtedly... I mean, you've got people like, you know, former President Clinton passing laws to enable the transfer of sensitive technology to China. So, you know, the idea, I mean, I think it's one of the worst kept secrets in the world that Israel has been passing US military technology to China for decades. I mean, Israel even sent a contingent in the 1970s to broker a deal to do exactly that. And occasionally you get, you know, the US hierarchy will say, oh, we don't really approve of that. But that doesn't stop them sending military technology to Israel, which they know is going to get passed to the Chinese. I mean, Israel's fully on board as well. Israel is fully on board with the Belt and Road Project in the Middle East.
Right.
So,
I said that from the very start of the Israel conflict. I go, do you know where it is? Have you seen the Belt and Road Initiative? Do you understand the land right there? And then when Biden announces they're building a port, I was like, oh, really? I'm shocked by this story, because right now the order out of chaos worldwide. And like you said, all this has to be paid for. And I do trace that with your help, but also all the way to the Bank of International Settlements, paying for both sides of all these wars. While we're fighting about who's right and wrong, I feel like the parent company that runs the world is very happy with what's going on, and that they don't want any peace. They want this to escalate to this point. And then at the same time, the whole thing with Russia and Ukraine, there are a lot of people on that in the public-private partnership that have one foot in both countries, you know? So it's just like everything that we're being told about everything. If you don't understand that there is a supranational group of bankers and billionaires and they're with their, that have a vested interest as stakeholders in the entire build back better of literally the whole world right now, then you can't really understand what's going on. To look at it from nation state to nation state, which is what they want to get rid of, it's impossible to put it together unless you suspend the idea that it's a conspiracy theory and do what you do, which is actually look at their documents and say, no. They're all involved, because the sanctions on Russia obviously didn't hurt Russia, but it certainly alienated America.
Yeah, I mean, when you think the sanctions on Russia, the way that started was utterly insane. So you think that basically what value is a global reserve currency? Why do people value a global reserve currency? because they can trust it, right? You know, so for example, the US dollar reserve system is backed by the law. It's got a, supposedly it's got a legal backing, right? Which we, and the American economy behind it. So, you know, that gives other countries such as China and Russia trust in that global reserve currency. In seizing Russia's foreign owned reserves, in seizing that, the US has done it before. It's done it to Iran and, you know, other countries. But in doing that in such a public way, taking Russians' reserve assets and seizing them, and now they're talking about spending them.
I know.
That basically, they've just said that the dollar as a reserve currency is totally useless. It's useless.
You can't trust them.
You can't trust it. Every country in the world is going to look at that, and look at that and think, well, the dollar's no use. We need something else.
Yeah.
Which, funnily enough, is exactly what the G7 bankers were talking about at Jackson Hole in 2019. Exactly. They want a new global financial system where there's a what they call the rebalancing of currencies. So they want to whittle away the dominance of the dollar. I don't think get rid of. I mean, I think if we look at the and I agree with Whitney Webb about this, and there's something that I've spoken to Whitney about as well, and Mark, that I think I can foresee a time where there would be no need for a reserve currency, because one of the points of what the Bank for International Settlements have been doing in terms of their interoperability, this thing that they're obsessed with, this interoperability, is that you would be able to make a payment in the yen, for example, from the US.
Right.
So you would be able to purchase assets from China directly in real time, instantaneously, pay in the dollar, and it's instantly purchased in the yen in China. Of course, there'll be an exchange mechanism of some sort, but that will be controlled in real time, instantaneously by AI. From your perspective, you know, you probably even look at, you know, you'll look at the asset and you'll price it in your head. You'll price it in dollars, and in China they'll price it in yen or whatever, renminbi or whatever they want to price it in at. But the point is, there'll be no need for clearing, which currently that work, you know, so currently clearing and settlement takes a few days, and that's a cost, you know, so-called cost, although why why that's a cost is, you know, it's all digital money, so it doesn't really, anyway, basically cutting out the middleman is the argument. But the point is, AI, which will control this global system, which Putin, in a speech given last year, is avidly in support of this idea. In fact, so you think about that. Think what's just happened to Russia in terms of its foreign reserve assets.
Right.
So it's just supposedly the US have just taken it, right? Now, you would think that would definitely make Putin wary of getting into any kind of like globalist venture with currency. He was talking last year about how he envisaged a future where, and he said this, now, something else we're told, Putin's a nationalist, right? Putin believes in Russia. He's supposed to be this nationalist. He said that he envisaged a future where no nation state controlled its currency.
Right.
Right. Now, if you're a nationalist, why would you say that? Why would you say that? That's you know, you're giving away, in if that's your, you know, your envisaged future, you're basically saying that I don't, and you're the head of the government, you're just saying I don't really want the government to control its issuance of its own currency. I'm not bothered about that,
right.
Which is, I mean, that's just you know, you can't therefore, as people do constantly argue, that he's a nationalist in that sense, when he's willing to give away the Russians' ability to issue its own currency, which I would say it doesn't, because the Russian central bank is as independent as all the other central banks.
Right, exactly.
But from a narrative perspective, we are supposed to believe that governments issue their own currency.
Yeah. I mean, they all seem to be in on when you do go look at their papers, which I strongly suggest everyone does that, because it's very hard to call anything a conspiracy theory when they're telling you what they're doing. We have the upcoming ARCOM and agenda. We have the World Health Organization treaty. But a lot of this stuff, all these countries are included, and all of them seem to be saying the same thing as Barack Obama signed on to Agenda 2030 in 2015 without telling the American people what it actually entails. I say the 17 development goals to full track and trace surveillance, totalitarian technocracy for everyone on planet Earth. But then Joe Biden in September of 2023 had a big gala event, you know, in the carcass formerly known as my home in New York City, with the UN and the Clinton Global Initiative and the IMF and the World Bank. And they were all talking about the halfway to Agenda 2030. And Joe Biden, even on the White House website right now, there's a whole thing halfway to global development goals from Biden Harris. And they're listing all of them and all the money that's going into the global governance model. So all these people, I feel like they already believe that they're going to live in Pan Am and we're going to all be in wards, and that they're going to just run it from Pan Am. And once in a while, they'll call up like a, you know, I guess, a, what are they called? Tributes from our wards to fight amongst themselves so they can be entertained. But I mean, this is how their work seems to be flowing. Now, I've had you a while. So before I let you go, I do want to talk to you about something that you say a lot. You do not believe that, or I'm not saying that you don't, I say from your reading, because I read everything you put out because it's amazing and it makes me think, which is great. We are not able, I don't believe in America, we can vote our way out of this, but whatever the case may be, and I mean this for the world, because there's, like I said, there's elections all over in Germany. We're seeing them one after another. There was just an election in Russia. There's many, many elections this year all over the world. At the end of the day, though, the people of our nations have to really understand that, you know, the model has shifted and not in our direction. And you have a whole piece in on your website about going towards freedom and liberty and privacy and all these things that we've given up without even paying attention, basically. And that the people are the ones that have to take that back. It's no leader. It's no government at this point. I don't believe the government in the United States, all the way up to the president. I think they're totally captured as it is by the public-private partnership. But what is your suggestion to the people to empower themselves? Because they're like, there's so many more of us, and even awake, so many more of just the awake people, even if that's 4% of the people on planet Earth, that's so much more than the people that are creating the global governance model. So what are solutions? What are suggestions for people at this point?
I think everyone needs to focus on being as independent as possible. So, you know, you need to be independent. So it's not, to a varying degree, some people, you know, if you live in a place where you've got no garden, then you can't grow your own food, for example. You know, so we can't all be completely independent in that respect. But we need to distance ourselves as far as possible from any kind of reliance on the state. Now, what that means is that, you know, for example, fuel, for example, you know, where do you get fuel from if you don't buy it from a corporate outlet somewhere nearby? People need to start thinking about, you know, forming collectives and being able to, for example, buy fuel on in bulk, you know, that kind of thing. So people need to be able to be as independent as they possibly can from the state. Now, when I talk about independence, which I talk about in quite a number of articles, and what I would call individual sovereignty,
right,
what I don't mean is being separate. You know, we have to work together. We have to work together to be as independent as possible, if that makes sense.
Yes, it does.
But we need to do it in our local communities. We need to start talking to each other. We need to get offline, right, and start talking to people around us and start sourcing the things that we need. When you break down what we really need, we need food, we need warmth, we need shelter, we need water, we need probably fuel, you know, we need power. These are the things that we need. Now, at the moment, most of us, 99% less so actually in the US, but certainly in the UK, 99.9% of people are totally reliant upon either the state and the corporate state. Now, I would say they're one and the same thing. They're the same blob, right? But nonetheless, we're reliant upon that for our essential needs. So we need to make sure that we're not, as much as possible. Right. Then once we are then more independent, then we can start forming networks with each other, you know, for currency and things like that. So there's a thing called the Let's Exchange. So it's the local exchange trade network, which is something that is in the UK that, you know, people do things like exchange time. So, you know, I might give my time as a gardener in exchange for you giving your time as an electrician.
Right.
That kind of that kind of idea.
Yeah.
So when you think that the whole push globally is to centralize power and centralize everything. So the logical response to that is to decentralize power and decentralize everything.
Right.
Now, once we do that in sufficient numbers, it's not hopeful that we might be able to defeat the agenda. It is inevitable that we will defeat it, because their only solution to that, if it's done in sufficient numbers, is just out and out violence.
Right.
That is the only resort. They'd have to send the planes and the tanks in. That's all they can do. Once they've lost and that's why they're so frightened of losing control of the narrative. That's why we've got you know, things like the Online Harms Act in the UK and the Digital Services Act, and the US are talking about their own Online Harms Act. Don't let that go through, because we've already let it go through over here, and it's a nightmare. So you know, it's the fact that they are frightened to the extent that they are frightened should tell us all that it is actually us that has the power. We have the power. We just need to realize our own agency and act on it and take control. And that doesn't mean standing on the barricades and waving flags. And, you know, although those protests is a perfectly useful thing, and lobbying and all that kind of thing is very useful, what will be really useful is for us to work together to maximize our independence, so that when the next time they tell us to do something stupid, we can just say, no, we're not doing it.
Right.
And that will change everything.
Yep. You're amazing. Ian Davis, tell everyone where to follow you and find you. Everyone that watches me or has seen my speeches has heard your name. I say to go follow you a lot, but now you tell everyone where you are. I highly recommend, this man has taught me more, and this is the tip of the iceberg. You can read his articles all the way back and your mind will be blown, and you will see the world a lot more clearer than maybe right now. So tell them where to go.
It's iandavis.com, which is my name spelled with two I's, so it's iaindavis.com. You can also reach me on my Substack, which is, I can't ever remember Substack, you wrote Substack.iandavis, I think, probably something like that. It's all on my website anyway, the links to it. And I'm on Twitter. I don't know why I'm on Twitter, but I am still on Twitter.
Yeah, me neither.
Sorry, X. X.
Me too.
X.
Hey, we're getting there.
All my social media stuff. So I'm also, that's something else I would advise people to look at, decentralized social media as well, Web3.0 stuff. So I'm on the Nostra protocol. It's not very easy to use at the moment, but the more people that use it, the better it will get. And that's a potential solution as well to censorship.
Great.
So, yeah. So
I follow you. Everyone, go right now to Ian Davis's website and go read about the public-private partnership and how that came to be. His three essays on that are the right direction to start empowering yourself to do what you need to do to be hyper-vigilant about your independence and creating the life that you want rather than the life they're telling you need to live. Thank you so much, Ian Davis. You're amazing. And I hope to see you again.
Thank you very much for inviting me, and keep up the good work yourself. It's excellent.
Thank you, sir.
Great news, guys. We've been beta testing with my founding members, the Mel Kay Show, live on Sunday nights at 7 p.m. And it is going incredibly well. We have a community that we all connect. We can share information. Questions are asked of me, of other people. We share back and forth. This is really a place to go on Sunday nights. Get ready for the week, share what's working, what's not working, how we can make things better, how we can align with each other. Wherever you are in the country, there's many things you can do. So we've added locals now. So on locals, you can also join us on Sunday nights, or you can join members.themelkayshowlive.com. The members at melkayshowlive.com is a community for you that continues 24/7, 7 days a week. We put up many different things there, ideas, documentaries that are great. people tell what they're doing in their local community. They can reach out to other people all over the country. It's kind of has a cool Facebook vibe, but it's really about community, fellowship, helping each other, organizing, all of that. You can also just join Locals and join us on Sunday nights where you can ask questions, interact with me. I'm going to have on some of my best guests. It's an incredible platform. It's just getting started. It's totally secure. And please join us Sundays at 7 p.m. Locals or members.themelkshowlive.com. I will see you there. This is so much fun and I'm so grateful. And now we have a totally secure community where we can all interact while we are fighting this battle for freedom and our future. See you there. Know that there are more than 60,000 known chemicals in tap water, and the EPA only tests for 91 of them? This is why we're so grateful that we partnered with Healthy Hydration. They offer whole home water filtration, shower filters, under-the-counter pre-filters, molecular hydrogen water machines, hydrogen water bottles, and so much more for a healthier home and family. So go to themelkshow.com and click on our partners page and check out Healthy Hydration and everything they have in store for your health and wellness today.